Let's have discussions about the role of government, the role of civil society. All of that's well and good. But the test of our politics, as I read the scriptures, is how the most vulnerable, the marginal, those on the edge are treated.
Welcome to the Theology Lab podcast. This is Scott Rice. Many of you will be well acquainted with our guest in this session. David Brooks is a political pundit who writes for the New York Times and regularly appears on the PBS NewsHour. His conversation partner, Jim Wallace, is the founder of the Sojourners Magazine and Sojourners Community in D.C. Jim holds the Archbishop Desmond Tutu Chair in Faith and Justice at Georgetown. In this session, David and Jim have a conversation on their relationship to evangelicalism and the topics of faith and politics. David and Jim have pretty clear differences when it comes to policies and politics. David's more conservative, and Jim represents a kind of rare but long-standing segment of progressive evangelical Christianity. These differences come out in the conversation. David looks at our personal formation, how we navigate our individual relationships with wisdom. Jim, on the other hand, often goes to the church's prophetic role in the changing face of our democracy. These differences matter, and I think that they'll generate some thinking and conversation for us around the relationship between faith and politics. I think you'll also hear in this conversation a deep shared conviction about the central way that faith animates our lives. David talks about this in terms of how we relate to the different spheres that we occupy, while Jim brings up our call to pursue truth and loving God as something that should surface across our public life. There's plenty more in this conversation, like helpful checks on a tendency to see the world as out to get us. And maybe surprisingly, how a concept like sin can add some needed nuance to our conversations on politics. Special thanks to Walter Kim, president of the National Association of Evangelicals, for moderating this discussion, a discussion on how faith shapes who we are and what we bring to all the parts of our lives, politics included. As always, you can learn more about Theology Lab at highrock.org/theologylab or email me, Scott, at theologylab@highrock.org.
We have the distinct pleasure of being with David and Jim, both who represent such insightful figures, able to contribute to the life of our country, both in insightful critiques, a hopeful vision of what life could be, represent different perspectives, but perspectives that I think across the spectrum, whether shared or not, are deeply appreciated. So thank you for being with us this evening. I'm just going to begin, because the topic is evangelicalism as a whole in this conversation. What is your own relationship to evangelicalism? And let's, Jim, we'll begin with you.
Well, it's good to be here again. I was born into it, raised in it. I remember a fiery revival preacher on a Sunday night pointed his finger, it looked like, right at me and said, if Jesus came back tonight, your mommy and daddy would be taken to heaven and you'd be left all by yourself. Got my attention as a six-year-old. I knew I'd have a five-year-old sister to support. So that was my first conversion. But later on, as a teenager, I was in Detroit, my home city, listening to my city, reading the papers and hearing the news and having adult conversations. And I remember something seemed very big and very wrong in my city about race. And I began to ask questions that just wouldn't go away from me. And I remember an elder in my church, he said, son, you have to understand, Christianity has nothing to do with racism. That's political, and our faith is personal. And that was a night for me of really kind of leaving it all and joining the sort of social movements of my time, because the thing that was turning me upside down, ripping me up inside, he said, had nothing to do with my faith. And I didn't have words for that back then, but I do now, which is God is personal, but never private. But I still, in that evangelical world, still think of myself as a person who believes. But my faith is not just personal, it's also public.
David, how about you?
Yeah, I have a weird story. I'm a babe in the woods in this. I grew up in a Jewish home, kept kosher for 27 years of adulthood, sent my kids to Jewish school. But I also happened to have been grown up in lower Manhattan. And I was also went to a church school, an Episcopal church, a mainline school. I was part of the choir at the church. And because it was lower Manhattan, we were 40% Jewish in the choir. And so we would sing the hymns, but to square it with our religion, we wouldn't sing the word Jesus. So the volume would go down in the church and then come back up when we were done. But I grew up with these two stories, the stories of Moses and the stories of Jesus. And it didn't matter to me at all because I didn't believe in God. So they were just good stories. And then in middle age, I came to believe in God and I came to believe in the God of Jesus. And so I became a Christian, though I felt more Jewish than ever before because I came to believe that the Old Testament is actually true, not just a story, but actually true. But so I became a Christian. I became a Christian in the way one does, which is you search. And when I, as I was searching for the faith that was inherent within me, I've learned that Christians give you books. And so in about 6 months, people gave me about 600 books, only 350 of which were different copies of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And so I was like on a journey and I started going to church and I had all these friends and I thought, well, Christianity is people who read Tim Keller and C.S. Lewis and Henry Nouwen and Eugene Peterson. And I went to a church, which I later learned was an evangelical church. So I didn't really know what that meant. And I had a lot of friends who were Christian, but they happened to be evangelical. And the category evangelical didn't mean a lot to me. It was people I admired. It was a pastor I admired. And it was a series of co-believers I admired. But the category evangelical was just not important to me. But that was the group I happened to fall into and happened to be inspired by. And I confess, this was about 2013, and I confess becoming an evangelical in 2013, I sometimes think was like investing in the stock market in 1929. It was maybe not the best thing to do, but it's worked for me. And I've since endured and experienced all the things that have been through the evangelical movement in the past decade.
Thank you both for sharing your stories. I mean, they're shared both in very winsome, somewhat humorous, but pointed ways. And I think that sets up our conversation really, really well. So we talked about the religion part of your own journey a bit and have alluded to the difficult nature of the relationship between religion and politics in general, people of faith, particularly the Christian version specifically. Give us a more principled lay of the land. How do you see the role of political engagement for people of faith? Why is it important? What are some common pitfalls that might occur? And David, I'm going to begin with you.
Yeah, so I had the unique, or not unique, but unusual experience of coming to faith really late in life, or relatively late, in my 50s, early 50s. I have to tell you that my coming to faith did not affect my politics particularly. And I'm a political pundit, so I'm in politics a lot. I spend all my days with politicians. And I think that's in part because I had been raised in the Jewish world or even in the secular world with the biblical metaphysic, with the certain ideas that I now come to believe are divinely true, but just thought were common sense before, which is that people are made in the image of God and we should orient our society toward those who are the least among us. And so Jim and I have a shared love of Dorothy Day. And the love of Dorothy Day preceded my belief in Christianity and belief in God. But I knew that when I saw Dorothy Day, someone who lived with the poor, surrendered to the poor and lived with the poor, I was seeing some piece of moral beauty. And that became part of the normal center of my life. And I knew that when I was looking at beauty, whether it's artistic or divine, I'm looking in a way that is attentive and not egotistical. And I'm trying to see people who are, you know, I'm looking into the face of God when I see a person. And so my politics were really oriented around that even before I came to faith. And it's interesting, Jim and I interpreted that in radically different ways. So I, for most of my life, I'm conservative. And Jim is anything but. But I interpreted my conservatism as a defense of a moral order that would give dignity to each individual. And I think Jim would say probably the opposite, but that doesn't separate the fact that we both are trying to serve the individual person who was so important that Jesus died for. And we may have different interpretations of how we serve that person, but I'm pretty confident that's the end to which we see politics. And so I see that religion and faith and art and culture as pre-political. And our interpretations of how that the goals that we're commanded to live out, that's reason. That's up to us. But the goals are commanded to us. And so to me, the pre-political nature of human life and the orientation of our moral commitments is more important than whether we support this or that bill. And so even though I write about politics, I'm a big believer in the phrase Samuel Johnson used, of all the things that human hearts endure, how few are those that kings can cause and cure. Meaning that what really matters is our treatment of each other. And our political manifestation of that is secondary.
There's so much in that we're going to be coming back to in a moment. But Jim, why don't you share some perspective on the role that religion can play in political discourse, the implications of that role, and some of the pitfalls of that?
Well, Dave and I do have a similar love of Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker. I remember when I was in college, in those student movements around racism and poverty and war, I wasn't aware of any Christians who were involved in any of those movements. In fact, they were mostly against the things I was doing. But I remember I could never, even though I'd left the church or it had left me, I'm not sure which, I could never quite get shed of Jesus. And I kept coming back. And I remember after a lot of organizing, I went back to read the New Testament on my own after years of organizing and all the rest. And I found this text that became my conversion text, the same conversion text as Dorothy Day. It's the 25th chapter of Matthew. It was the most radical thing I'd ever read. At the time, I was reading, like a lot of students like me, Ho Chi Minh, Che Guevara, and Karl Marx, and this was more radical than all of them. And I called the "It Was Me" text. Jesus, I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty. I was naked. I was stripped of everything. I was a stranger, meaning immigrant there. I was in prison. I was sick, and you didn't come to me. And they said, "Lord, when do we see you hungry and thirsty and naked and sick and in prison? We didn't know it was you." And then he says, "Well, as you've done to the least of these, you've done to me." I never read anything as radical as that. Here's the Son of God sitting in judgment in that text, his last teaching before going into the city of Jerusalem. And he says, "I'll know how much you love me by how you treat them, those who are poorest and most vulnerable." And that's the key, I think, to Christian politics. We can disagree on philosophy and debates, but the Hebrew prophets made clear in the Hebrew scriptures that a nation is judged by how it treats the poorest and most vulnerable. How they're doing is the test of a nation's righteousness, not its military firepower, its GNP, or its popular culture, but how it treats the poorest. That, to me, is the touchstone of what Christians ought to do in public life, is defend those who are marginal, on the edge. The economics and politics of Jesus turn this world upside down. I'm here at Georgetown, and the politics in Washington are the least of these are the least important. And I'm trying to turn those things upside down, where Jesus says those who who are left out and left behind are the ones I want you to pay particular attention to. How they're doing is to me the test of Christian politics.
Both of you have, in your own unique ways, fallen to the issue of the image of God in all people, and to this notion of a predisposition to defend the least of these, or to minister to the least of these. And David, you described it in this language of almost this kind of moral order and instinct that you had that was, kind of faith-seeking understanding, so to speak, this deep embedded sense, even before you became a Christian. And then becoming a Christian is discovering the details of, oh, this is where it came from. And Jim, you're talking about this ethic of Jesus that enters into the conversation that Ho Chi Minh, Marx, others, couldn't offer anything equally as radical. So very, very different starting points, and yet you've come to some very similar themes here of dignity and defense of the least of these. I want to push now a bit of saying, okay, maybe there is this universal moral instinct that we can access, general grace, general revelation, depending on what Christian tradition you come from. Or there's a sense of a radical Jesus that would call us to, a program of overturning the world, or however you might put it, Jim. And yet we are finding ourselves increasingly in a secularized setting, and increasingly in a setting in which politics now seems to have usurped the role of religion. So it's possible to maybe stay, to your point, David, in a realm in which it's disengaged or unmoored from religion, to you, Jim, detached from the radical Jesus. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that politics, political discourse has usurped the role traditionally held by religion? And then once again, what are the implications of that for our national life?
I guess I'll start. First of all, I'm amazed that I came to a co-belief with Jim. He did through Che Guevara. I did through William F. Buckley and Milton Friedman. And so God is big. God is pretty big. My own belief is that politics has usurped religion for many people. And I say that for two reasons. One, a sense that moral formation and spiritual formation have become deficient. And so a lot of people, secular and Christian, have found themselves in a moral void. And when people are in a moral void, they need morality. And so they want a moral system that will give them moral purpose. And the radicalism of the gospel has been replaced by politics. And so politics gives you the illusion that you're in a moral world. It gives you the illusion that you're in a moral landscape. But instead of it sin and redemption, grace and surrender, it's us versus them. Politics gives you the illusion of community. But instead of living with your neighbor and surrendering for your neighbor, it's watching TV and being outraged at the other side. And politics gives you the illusion of moral action. But instead of what Dorothy Day did, which was sitting with the hungry, it's being outraged at what your political opponents are doing. And so we don't have normal politics in this society, which is about the distribution of power and the distribution of resources, which is the normal debate. We have the politics of recognition. Do you recognize me as special? Do you oppose those as shameful? And to me, politics is an illusion and a drug that tries to replace a real moral landscape. And so it gives you the illusion of having community, belonging, and moral mission, and a moral landscape, but it's all a seduction. And so it has replaced religion for many people, Christian and secular, in American life. And if you're asking religion to give you salvation, to give you meaning, to give you redemption, to give you a sense of moral formation and moral and spiritual improvement, you're asking more of politics than it can give you. And I fear that we've made an idol of politics, and we've ruined politics along the way.
Jim, before we get to you, I'm going to pull something out a little bit more from you, David, so we have some clarity on what you mean by it's replaced kind of the moral order. I get how community might be replaced by politics, you know, belonging to a particular party. Some of the means, the mechanisms, you know, the identification and the vilification, I get that. What do you mean, however, when you say it's replaced a sense of the moral order? How does politics do that?
Yeah, I mean, the moral order in, well, to quote Solzhenitsyn, the line between good and evil runs within every human heart. And that's a Christian notion that we are gloriously made, but deeply broken. But in the politicized morality, the line between good and evil is between us and them. And so it does not require any sense of humility. It doesn't require a sense of self-abnegation. It just requires you to go after the other side. And it's a cheap morality. And I find an ultimately unsatisfying morality. But it's the morality that has pervaded, I think, American life. And then the final thing I'll say, and this specific to evangelicals, there are a few things more dangerous than a siege mentality, the idea that the world is out to get you. And I think in many realms of the evangelical world, that morale, that sense that the world is full of villains who are out to get us, and therefore we are justified in doing anything, and that the ends justify the means, has corrupted evangelical life in some quarters. Once Jesus did not say that the ends justify the means. I mean, we can debate a lot of things about what Jesus said, but that's not one of them. But unfortunately, the church has some parts of the church have embraced that.
Thank you. Jim, turning to you.
David wrote a column a while back, David, about how things have gotten so politicized in too many white evangelical churches, with that us and them, the pushing of people out, the naming of people who are named as the other, even demonized. And there was this lawyer in the Bible who asked a question of Jesus. I think it was a Washington lawyer. The tone of voice gives him away. He asked Jesus, well, how do I have eternal life? And Jesus said, well, you know the law. What does it say? It's, well, you love God with your whole heart and soul and mind, your neighbor is yourself. You got it right. And then he said, yeah, but who's my neighbor? And he wasn't saying, who is my neighbor? How can I welcome them? How can I include them? He's saying, exactly who is my neighbor here? He's trying to restrict. And the us and them issue is so deep now in American politics that I'm very concerned about leading even to the rise of political violence. And Jesus tells him a story that we all know as the Good Samaritan story, where a Samaritan who most Judeans didn't believe there were any good Samaritans. They were the other, they were half-breed, they were racially stayed away. And this other good Samaritan helped someone other than him. And he became an example of whom Jesus said is how you find your neighbor. Your neighbor often doesn't live next door. That's the Good Samaritan parable for me. And so how do we, as John Meacham says, as a political scientist or his historian, turning people from neighbors into enemies is a great danger for democracy. So who our neighbor is, to me, is a fundamental question for democracy today. So instead of changing our pathways, really, to find our neighbors who are not always in our neighborhood, to demonize and call for the destruction even of our enemies who should be neighbors, is a problem not just in our personal relationships, but in our politics. And so David and I are in agreement on the image of God. That first chapter, the first book of the Bible, 126, God making humankind in God's image and likeness. These assaults on the rights or voting rights or human rights of enemies, these are an assault on Imago Dei. They're literally an assault on Imago Dei. So how to bring that to our politics, not just our personal relationships, but in our collective relationship, or at Georgetown, they would say, how to bring dignity and justice to the common good. How do we do that? How do we bring that back to the common good? That's, I tell my students all the time, don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. And to me, going deeper means to go to what Jesus said.
I asked David, as a political pundit, to draw out a little bit more on what he meant by the replacing of the moral order typically of given by religion, by politics. And now, Jim, as a religious and political activist, I'm going to ask you to clarify something. You know, you've worked so compellingly and have exemplified the sort of convergence of an ethic of Jesus and political activism. And I'm not going to ask you to reflect a bit, maybe even self-critically, not to yourself personally, but to the project of religious activism, political activism. What is a pitfall that you may have discovered when people with, you know, deep religious convictions enter into the realm of politics? What is a pitfall that you would caution us to avoid?
I think the danger or the temptation of politics for people of faith is to become a chaplain for one side or the other. We must not be a chaplain for the right or the left. Dr. King said it best of all when he said, he wanted to remind the church that our role is to not be the master of the state or the servant of the state, but the conscience of the state. And that will often make us have to be critical of different sides in the political discussions. And sometimes, I know David probably feels this way too, sometimes you feel politically homeless because you're not lining up with the parties. And so how do you, in the name of Jesus, with those values in his teachings, with that Hebrew scripture about the image of God, how do you test and challenge the politics of left and right when they all want you, they all want religion to be their chaplain, to justify them and give them religious affirmation, when really what they need is often prophetic critique?
I want to pick up now on the thread of formation that both of you have, in your own ways, again, touched upon, whether it's the ease by which we fall into the trap of becoming a chaplain for one side, or the ways in which we have become disordered in our demonization, vilification of people who have different persuasions. So give us a positive vision. What would enable us to enter into a place of moral and spiritual character formation in our political engagements? And what role specifically does the church play in this? Yeah, David, why don't you kick us
okay. off? Okay, so I wrote a piece about evangelicals about a year ago, which I quoted you, Walter. And I put the phrase spiritual formation in the rough draft of the article. And my editors were like, what the heck is that? And they had like 60 like question marks in that 4,000 word piece. Like, I tried to use the phrase agape love. They're like, what the heck is that? and so it was a sobering reminder that some of the language that we speak with each other is a very alien language to a lot of the secular world. And the people at the New York Times are hopefully sophisticated human beings. But spiritual formation was a mystery, and I really had to explain that to them. And so I've tried in my life, to being a secular writer, I'm a secular writer, try to translate some of the concepts that we may find familiar to the secular world and try to do it in a way that's helpful to us. And so when I think of spiritual formation or moral formation, I think of three things. One, trying to restrain, find ways to restrain our own natural selfishness. Two, trying to find an ideal toward which we can direct our lives, which is for us as Jesus. But three, more practically, is that how to be considerate to other human beings in the complex situations of life. So how do I ask for forgiveness and offer forgiveness? How do I notice at a dinner party that somebody's not feeling included and try to include them? If I'm a kid, how do I break up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend without breaking their heart? And to me, the part of spiritual and moral formation that is absent in the church and in the secular world is these social skills of being considerate in the daily activities of life. And I've been helped in trying to understand those skills through a writer who's not particularly religious, but I think her instincts are deeply religious, which is Iris Murdoch, who's a great novelist and philosopher. And she said the essential moral act is the act of casting what she called a just and loving attention. So when I see somebody in an airplane, I just got off an airplane, I want to cast a just and loving attention on that person. And her novels are about people who don't cast just and loving attention to each other because their vision of each other are egotistical, selfish, And so to me, moral formation and spiritual formation can be seen as a lofty, ethereal thing, but I try to bring it down to the practical level. If I'm sitting next to you in a plane, how do I cast a just and loving attention on you? How do I open up our conversation? How do I ask you a series of questions so that I'm respecting your privacy, but gradually giving you an invitation to talk about whatever you want to talk about? And to me, I think that those practical questions of how do I ask you about what's wrong with your work? How do I ask you about your family? How do I ask you your pride and your kids? Those practical questions are the material aspects of spiritual and moral formation that sometimes we're too ethereal to really focus on.
I think we've got to take your question, Walter, in the historical context, in the moment that we are in. And I'm deeply concerned about the trajectory of our politics now, which is fear to hate and then to violence. That's a civic faith of fear, hate, and violence. How do we create a civic faith, maybe civic discipleship, or challenging that trajectory? I just was writing a chapter here today on Galatians, chapter for a book on Galatians 3:28. This radical text in Christ, Jew or Gentile, bond or free, male or female. And I learned this was a baptismal invocation at all the baptisms of the early church. They were saying, overcoming these divisions of race, class, and gender, all there, overcoming them was an essential vocation of the early church. So much so they said it at the baptisms, even an early creed. Now, what does that say about our struggling with democracy? My great fear of my white evangelical tradition is that we are bound more and more by two identities. One is racial and one is political. And we are not meant to be a tribe in politics, to fight for our own tribe. We're meant to be the people who bring others together into a new community. And that to me is a very challenging thing right now. That'll take more than politics, who wins or who loses left or right. It's going to take going deeper into how we regard each other and how our role vocationally is to bring the tribes together, especially when the elephant in the room in American politics is we are becoming more and more no longer a white majority, but a nation of where the majority are minorities. That'll take a whole different kind of world in politics, and who's going to guide us to that multiracial, multicultural democracy? I can't think of a better me to do that, but the churches. We are, the body of Christ is the most diverse human community on the whole planet, yet not so here. How do we move in that direction? That'll take a civic discipleship that helps us overcome our tribalism in favor of that new community that these early Christians said, here's what it means to follow this rabbi that we've chosen to follow.
I find it very interesting in your answers, both of them really compelling and picking up on some similar themes, but applying them in some distinct ways. David, perhaps this is your conservatism showing up, your application in the individual expressions of kindness, the person sitting next to you on the plane, and Jim, your instinct to go to this kind of civic engagement, and perhaps that reflects a bit of your own political instincts. Now I want to turn our attention, whether it's the individual engagement or more civic corporate engagement, to a mediating community of just a local church who is composed of individuals, but the local church is also composed of groups from different political persuasions, multi-generational, multi-ethnic, and so forth. So what is your advice on how to build this kind of kindness, discipleship, in whatever form you've so delineated it, in the context of a local church, when you have issues that divide us, issues like war, LGBTQ inclusion, politics in general, race in particular? How can you express kindness but have principled discussions, recognizing that there are legitimate issues at stake with deep convictions that differ?
I think the worst thing about a church or a local church is that it becomes sociologically predictable, that the views held in that church are indistinguishable from the views held by the demographics in that church. That's a problem. We are meant to be, Walter, my church left theology for politics. It left theology behind toward a new moral majority, religious right politics. It politicized. Now, that can be done on the left too, but I don't see that happening in white evangelical churches. So how do you get back to our theology that should make us theologically distinguishable instead of sociologically? In other words, how are we different? How are we the counterculture that Jesus, I think, called us to be? A lot of my students are in the category at Georgetown of the none of the aboves, the nuns. They're not affiliating with any religion or church. Most still believe in God. It's not a secular movement. What they're looking for is courage and conviction. And they're looking for people who are doing things to make things better in a community. So I'd like them to walk past a local church and say, I'm not sure I believe in all that doctrine that might be there, but that's the place where we in this community talk about our problems, where we talk about issues of fairness and justice and public safety. And this is where we talk about how to make this community different and better. That could pull young people in, I think, and then have a conversation with them. So I want to see a multiracial and a multi-generational conversation happening in our churches about what it means to be public disciples, along with our deep personal faith that David and I share in Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I'm reminded, I have a buddy of mine who's a pastor in Virginia, where I live in D.C., and his church got divided on political grounds. So he would give his sermons, and then without citing the source, he would insert sentences from the Beatitudes, from the Sermon on the Mount. And at the end of that, he'd be out the front door, people were coming out, and they'd be shaking his hand, and they'd say, I really like your sermon, but I didn't like that part. That part was so woke. Said, no, that was the Beatitudes. And so now I'm going to sound like a super lefty like Jim. But I do think, I guess I'd say two things. The first is, you mentioned you had Russell Moore, I think, on this conversation. And Russell said something to me that I think is troubling. He said, in many congregations, the most spiritually healthy people are quiet, and the most spiritually unhealthy people are loud, and they're demanding politics, and the spiritually healthy people are just laying low. And I think it's hard for pastors to deal with that kind of sense of division. But I would insist upon it. And I'm married to a woman named Ann Snyder, who I'm now going to bring in her magazine, which is called Comment Magazine. You should all read it. Called Public Theology for the Common Good. And this issue, Remembering the Spheres, and it's really based on the idea of Abraham Kuyper, the Dutch theologian and who became prime minister. And it's the concept of the spheres. We have different spheres in life. And that the religious sphere is for most of us the most profound sphere. The political sphere is a different sphere. The athletic sphere is a different sphere. And we use different mentalities and we assign different values to the different spheres. But preserving that sense that some spheres are more fundamental than others, I think is absolutely fundamental. That the salvation of souls, the care of our spiritual natures is the fundamental sphere. And that whether you agree in politics, that's secondary. And you use a different mentality, a different kind of thinking to think about that sphere. And if Jim and I disagree, like I happen to be a rabid New York Mets fan, and if Jim likes, I don't know, who, if you like a baseball team or the Boston Red Sox or whoever, like that's a different sphere. And we're not going to make that the primary sphere of our relationship. And so I do think this understanding of different spheres of life that keeps faith central and keeps the other spheres secondary is just essential to keeping harmony within a diverse and pluralistic congregation.
And I think you've got to go deeper than different spheres, because there are issues right now. I'm going to keep going back to some texts that I think need to change us. When Jesus said, you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. The opposite of knowing the truth is captivity. And a lot of our congregations are now in that captivity. The thing I'm most worried about for our democracy is how people are living in different worlds of information, different informational worlds. And I think pastors have a vocation in some ways similar to journalists like David to tell the truth. Truth has to be told. I love stories like when a pastor's wife that I know in Georgia was practicing with the choir one day, and they had their prayer before service as usual, and the scared director of the choir said, "Oh Lord, please help us from those drug cartels, those immigrants who are coming with their drugs and leprosy and violence and guns. Please help the soldiers stop them." And she said, stop. We don't lie in church. We don't lie in church. That isn't true. That's not what's happening. I've had, Walter, pastors that you and I know say to me, "I have my people for only maybe 2 hours a week if I'm lucky. Fox News has them 24/7. I can't compete. I can't compete." So truth-telling, to me, is going to be very important in the life of the church. When lies and misinformation and disinformation dominate our media more and more, and we're separated from being in those different universes of information, how do we get back to truth-telling, which isn't partisan? It's got to go all ways. But truth-telling, I think, is a central vocation of local churches.
I'm going to take the last 10 minutes to field some of the questions that we've been getting from our participants. I'm going to begin with a question that comes from a millennial, is maybe straddling the Gen Z as well. From the perspective that you have of decades worth of observation on cultural life of America, political life, religious life of America, when you think about the younger generation, the generation coming up, the generation that will receive your legacies and their distrust of institutions, what do you think the younger Christians should be doing to develop an alternative framework for Christian political engagement?
I have a friend named Mark Labberton, who you, Walter, we know, who used to be at Fuller, is just retired as president of Fuller Seminary out in California. And he described a series of faith practices and rituals that defy all of our expectations. And they would combine something that would be conventional for maybe an evangelical Protestant, but they would combine that with a Japanese tea ceremony. They would combine that with, he mentioned to me, Syrian Christians who were in celebration of martyrdom. And so it was really a global approach to the church, which would combine all these different traditions in ways that might be disorienting to a lot of people. But I found it heartening. And I will say, having spent a lot of time over the last 10 years going to Christian colleges, I guess I was introduced to faith really through Christian colleges, weirdly, through the faculties, the students. And I found it heartening. And it was only later that I actually found the congregations. And I was like, oh, I'm kind of disappointed. and so when I was at the Christian colleges, my wife went to Wheaton, but other colleges, Hope or wherever you were, Biola or Westmont, I would always think, you guys feel embattled. You should not feel embattled. You have what the world wants. You have a spiritual language. You have a sense of spiritual purpose. You have great spiritual resources. And I teach at Yale and the University of Chicago, which are prestigious secular universities, but they don't have what a lot of evangelical colleges have, which is a sense of how to spiritually mentor young people to lead lives of purpose and grace. And so I would always say, I'm coming from a world that has a lot of worldly prestige, but a lot of spiritual vacuum. And when I go to a Christian college, I'm entering a world which may not have worldly prestige, doesn't have as much money, but has spiritual resources the world is hungering for. And so my language always to those folks is, appreciate what you have, be not afraid, because you have what the world really is hungering for. And you should go forth into the world, not with a sense of besiegement, but a sense of confidence.
The best part of my week is teaching students at Georgetown. Many of them are not, they're disaffected, they're not current to anything, but they're drawn to, let's go back to the good news. They're drawn to good news. Quote our mutual friend, Mark Labberton, who once said to me, as the president of the largest evangelical seminary in the world, perhaps, he said, evangelicalism is destroying the evangel. The evangel was that word in Greek that Jesus used in his opening statement, his opening gig, his Nazareth manifesto, quoting Isaiah, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news, evangel, to the poor. That was his opening statement. And I find students are drawn to that. They say things like, I never knew about the Black church till this class. I like what I see. Or what is this thing you call Catholic social teaching? Even at Georgetown, they haven't heard about that. There's all kinds of things, as David's saying, in our churches, in our histories, our traditions. And the institutions often neglect or even cover them up and get on with their own business of power. But I want to get students back to hearing the best in our traditions. That Black church was at the core of the civil rights movement, without which there wouldn't have been a civil rights movement. That Catholic social teaching of Dorothy Day and so many others that really talk about dignity and the soul of a nation, the common good. So I'm not a super lefty David. I think we shouldn't be super lefties or super righties, but how to get back to the core of what we say we believe. That Sermon on the Mount, I love the Beatitude story. When I read the Sermon on the Mount after years of organizing in the student movement, I realized I'd never had a sermon preached to me in my evangelical home church on the Sermon on the Mount. That was for another dispensation, for when we get to heaven. I said, what good will that do there? I found this whole, the Beatitudes that turn the world literally upside down. Jesus came to change the world and our lives with it. And that, I find young people, even if they're skeptical about religion and institutions, they're very drawn to. So I find a real hunger for what our faith is really at core is about. And a lot of young people are getting quite excited about it.
I'm going to ask a question that synthesizes, and love to hear from both of you, a theme that I'm reading in a number of the questions. You know, we have different political persuasions with respect to the emphasis on the individual responsibility or what a policy can accomplish. We have different views on the relative spheres of our engagement. But what happens when they're all overlapping? When the individual Christian formed in the church nevertheless has to vote on a particular issue, how do we provide theological and moral formation that helps us in these intersecting moments, that takes seriously our individual responsibilities, of course, to be Christ-like in kindness, to personally engage in defending the least of these? But we're also having to enter into the political responsibilities and life of our nation, and that entails policies. So when we bring those things together, our individual responsibilities, our political engagements, what are some guiding principles that you would offer us as a way of concluding this conversation, as kind of a parting thought that each of you would have a minute each?
I'll go first. So I once was watching TV, a TV coverage of one of the Pope's Easter sermons, and the Pope gave his sermon, and the TV reporter came on afterwards and said, "Nothing new here." It's like, that's not his job, is to be new. His job is to say what's true. You know, I would say in my life, I was a lefty. I was socialist early in life. Then I worked for, I voted for Ronald Reagan. I'll confess that. And now I've shifted back to, I'm probably a conservative Democrat now. And so those commitments are ephemeral. It depends. I think Reagan's policies were right for a period of stagflation when we wanted to boost growth. And I think they were right for a period of the Cold War. I think now with savage inequalities, I think Joe Biden's policies of redistributing money to the working class are probably more accurate than whatever the Republicans are offering. And so those are context driven. And so my attitude is that I'll do what I think is right for the time. But religious commitments are not context driven. They're based on permanent human realities. And so for me, it's very easy to maintain the permanent amidst the ephemeral of politics.
It's very helpful.
I'm surprised in saying we've got to bring sin back into the conversation, both left and right. Personal agency and responsibility, and how our individual choices impact all of us. The left needs to hear that strongly. But structural sin, Walter, as you and I have talked about, which is often missed and just omitted on the white evangelical side, how these structures, these principalities and powers just serve or destroy human life. So let's bring that back in, and let's have discussions about the role of government, the role of civil society, all of that's well and good. But the test of our politics, as I read the scriptures, is how the most vulnerable, the marginal, those on the edge are treated. That is the test. So rather than voting for our tribe, who's going to be best for our tribe, who's going to serve our self-interest as we define those, often by race and class and not so much Jesus values, who's going to do that isn't the issue. Who's going to be our guy to support us? It's who is going to make sure that the ones lifted up, as we've said tonight, all through the scriptures are being attended to, and how we can make their lives flourish as well as our own. That to me is a test of Christian politics.
Thanks for listening to the Theology Lab podcast. You can find us on the web at highrock.org/theologylab. And if you like this podcast, you can subscribe and help us out by leaving a rating or a review.